Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, as a new group of young Americans looks ahead to adulthood, those with queer identities see a horizon previous generations could not have imagined. We'll spend this hour with sociologist Mary Robertson, who spent years getting to know the teens who hung out at a California drop-in center for LGBTQ youth and discovered they draw a distinction between people who wish to fit into the binary mainstream culture and those who prefer to embrace identities that view gender and sexual orientation as fluid. We'll talk about how that idea shapes their understanding of themselves and about why young people whose families accept their queer identities still consider themselves lucky. Our conversation starts after a short break. Many people celebrate the way the word queer has been reclaimed by LGBTQ folks. But the word is also being redefined by young people who claim that identity. In a culture where being gay is now largely viewed as normal, being queer is something else. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Mary Robertson is assistant professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos. She spent 3 years getting to know teens who hung out at a place called Spectrum. It's one of those drop-in resource centers for LGBTQ-identified youth, and Robertson became a fixture there in order to understand how these kids developed their sexual and gender identities. She came away convinced that the LGBTQ community encompasses very different kinds of relationships to the broader world. There are homonormative folks who comfortably inhabit mainstream identities when society accepts them. And there are those for whom queer identity makes a mainstream identity improbable or simply undesirable. Her book is called Growing Up Queer: Kids and the Remaking of LGBTQ Identity. Mary, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here.
What kinds of questions did you want to answer in the time you spent at Spectrum? Or did those questions present themselves to you after you started hanging around there?
I think, you know, it's a little bit of both. I mean, I went into the project really wanting to answer the question of how do we become sexual people? How do we become gendered people? And hoping that, you know, at that kind of adolescent stage would be a moment that I could observe some of that. And so these questions that, you know, I wanted to know how kids understood themselves as sexual and gendered persons. And so those, you know, those are the questions I asked. I wanted to ask what their family life was like. How did they grow up? Did they have how many parents in their household? Did they go to church? Did they, what was school like for them? So those types of questions. But then, of course, the longer that you're in the space and the more I got to know people, then new and different questions developed.
So Spectrum is a center for teens and young adults. It's kind of nestled within a larger LGBTQ organization called The Resource. Besides, you know, aiming to serve younger members of the community, what makes Spectrum different from its parent organization?
So that was something that was really important to distinguish in the book, is that the space for the kids seemed to be what I would call a queerer space, and what the kids themselves called a queerer, you know, a queer space, and that they sort of resisted the idea of wanting to fit into the mainstream, or they resisted the idea of kind of the typical kind of access to a liberal rights framework that the larger organization was maybe striving for. And I think part of that is a typical adolescent reaction of wanting to distinguish themselves from adults. But I also think it's certainly there was much more visibility of kids who were marginalized in other ways other than just their sexual and gender identity. So kids who perhaps were experiencing homelessness, kids who were having trouble staying in school, getting enrolled in school, attending school, kids who were having, who didn't have access to resources in terms of money and that kind of thing. So it was a space where kids struggled in a lot of different ways, not just with their sexuality and gender.
So what does queer mean to them, to these kids that you focused on for 3 years?
I think that when, you know, I talked to Ernie at one point. There's a quote in the book, and what Ernie says is that for him, being queer means that he is a person of color, and in particular a Chicano, that he is poor, that he has, you know, doesn't conform in terms of typical kind of body size and body appearance. And all of those things were part of what it meant to be queer to him. And then also that was tied to his sexual identity, his sexual desires. But yes, this idea of being able to move beyond just being gay, for example, to think of these other ways that he was also queered in society.
So to the extent that a lot of these kids conceived of themselves as existing outside the norms set up by the broader world, was that a result partly of feeling rejected by mainstream society, or was it deliberately a choice not to change themselves to fit anybody else's preconceived notions?
I think it depends, you know, and I think that that's something I try to frame in the book, and particularly when I use I use feminist scholar Sarah Ahmed's idea of queer orientation. And what's, you know, one of the ways that she frames it is that queer orientation is both the way that a person sort of takes a different line, you know, kind of strays from the straight line in whatever way we want to sort of interpret that. And so it can have to do with wanting to remain separate from the mainstream and exist outside of that. But then there's also the ways that society queers others, the way that society will decide for you that you're queer, that you don't belong, that you don't fit. And so even if you perhaps would like to fit into the mainstream, you may not, for whatever reasons. And again, examples might include, you know, you're struggling with a learning disability, or you're a fat person, or you're a poor person, or these things that keep, you know, so sometimes it's externally attached to you. And I think sometimes there is a resistance to be part of the mainstream.
So I think lots of people will have heard the term heteronormative. You also discuss the homonormative nature of some LGBTQ culture, at least at the resource. Can you explain both of those terms for us so we know what we're talking about?
Yeah, you bet. So heteronormativity is the idea of heterosexual pairing of society being the norm. So the idea that men and women are meant to be sexually paired, that that's natural, that that's normal. Heteronormativity also extends into ideas about gender normativity. So not only are men and women meant to be paired together sexually, but men are meant to behave and act a certain way, and women are meant to behave and act a certain way, and those things are complementary, not the same, if that makes sense. So heteronormativity really encompasses that both sexuality and gender. And then homonormativity is a term that Lisa Duggan is the person I'm most familiar with having coined this term. And she talks about the idea of members of what we call the LGBT community adopting mainstream norms in terms of their sort of relationships. And so, for example, same-sex marriage might be argued to be an example of heteronormativity, because that's what you're meant to do, is pair up with someone else, be committed to each other, monogamous, create a family, that kind of thing. And so it's sort of when members of the LGBT community adopt these sort of mainstream norms that are often associated with heteronormativity.
It's a really interesting thing to think about, because I think many people will be aware that lots of LGBT folks have worked and advocated for years just to sort of be allowed to exist within mainstream society, but that doesn't mean everybody wants that.
Yes, and I want to make it clear that these terms that I'm using, I mean, these are all, you know, contested in terms of, you know, I think it's important to honor the fact that, you know, in talking about homonormativity, I'm not suggesting that there shouldn't be same-sex marriage, or that LGBT people shouldn't have the same rights as everyone else and be you know, pursue their true selves. That's, you know, I think that's really important. But it is, you know, there is this important larger critique about how are we reproducing the structural systems that keep leaving certain people out by suggesting that there is a correct or a normal way to be. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. We should note here, you share in the book that you are not gay yourself, and it's not that should qualify you or disqualify you, but I wonder what drew you to this research specifically?
Yeah. You know, my area of specialization in sociology is sexualities, and that's definitely where I'm interested in where my research is and where I teach. And so, you know, interestingly and not surprisingly, the scholarship in whether it's in sociology or the humanities and in other areas is often has been led by LGBT identified people, has been centered around LGBT identities, because if you're studying the social world and trying to understand a phenomena, it's often what happens is we end up studying the marginalized phenomena because that's where the socialization process becomes obvious. And so, for example, heterosexuality is so normal and taken for granted, it's often not studied, and that's starting to change. But often, you know, so the attention goes towards this sort of marginalized identity. So part of it is that a lot of the literature leading up to my research project and what I knew about sexualities had to do with non-heterosexualities. So that's a piece. But part of it also was that I was interested in vulnerable young people. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend who is a volunteer in this space, and I had the opportunity to become an adult volunteer at Spectrum and hang out. And so part of it has to do with just the opportunities that are available to you. And when you're an ethnographer, you really have to grab some of those opportunities as they come. And when you're studying and a student, you have to grab those opportunities as they come. And so, you know, in some ways, it also had to do with what was available to me. But I also want to make clear that it's difficult to get permission to do research on sexualities with minors. Hmm. And so I think it would have been much harder for me to go into, say, for example, a public school and do some of the same, ask some of the same questions and do some of the same research I wanted to do. Whereas this particular center, I think the LGBT community and these organizations are very pro-research. I think they very much want there to be good evidence-based research on their communities, but they're also spaces that are more comfortable with talking about sex and with acknowledging sex and sexuality. And so it wasn't unusual for me as a researcher to say, hey, can I spend some time out here and hang out and see what I can learn? I think that would have been harder in a public school.
You also note in the book that based on the way you look, you have short hair and a preference for androgynous clothes. Some people might assume without asking that you are, in fact, a lesbian. Did it feel important to you to clarify to the people you got to know at Spectrum and the resource who might think you were a lesbian to let them know that you were not? Or did that seem beside the point to you?
It's a great question, and it's something that it's very important to me and something I have thought about every single step of this whole process and continue to think about. The norms in the space were that you... So first of all, the space encouraged all LGBT-identified people and then also allies. So mm-hmm. there was a norm that allies to the LGBT community were welcome and part of the community, and there were people there who identified as allies. So that was normal. But it wasn't normal to, you know, publicly go around and say, you know, hi, my name's Mary, I'm straight, or hi, my name's, you know, that wasn't something you did. And actually, that's really, I'm guessing we'll get there, but that actually is a little bit different when it comes to gender. But so when you wouldn't announce your sexual identity to people. But I was never covert about it, and I was never covert as a researcher. People knew that I was there researching. And so the more I was around kids and who got to know me, they would obviously, through context, would start to learn that my partner was a man and that, you know, through these various conversations. And so I guess I say all that to say that it would have been outside the norm for me to go around announcing my identity, but it wasn't something I kept from people. Mm-hmm. So... It was very interesting, and then to think about that, I think, in the terms of understanding sexuality from a social construction, how do we make these decisions about people?
My guest is Mary Robertson. She's assistant professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos, and author of Growing Up Queer, Kids and the Remaking of LGBTQ Identity. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Mary Robertson, who is assistant professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos, and author of Growing Up Queer, Kids and the Remaking of LGBTQ Identity. You can join us by calling 800-933-5372. Mary, what are some of the ways these young people started to be aware of their queer identities or their non-heteronormative identities? And what did they do to explore and understand those aspects of themselves?
Mm-hmm. You know, so when I would sit down and ask those questions and ask, you know, I would ask the kids to, you know, how do you identify your sexuality? And then I would ask them sort of how did they come to know that? And oftentimes, there, you know, there are these markers in their memory of being, having their queerness pointed out to them. And so, for example, with you know, with boys that were gay, their sort of earliest memory, if I would ask them how did you know you were gay, would talk. Their earliest memories were about not acting like a proper boy. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes it was associated with this gender queerness, especially when I'm talking about being kids, you know, being pretty young. And so I think sexuality is kind of less in their framework. So that was certainly one of the things that kids would talk about. But then as kids started to become more aware of their own sexuality and their own desires, kids would talk about seeing, for example, watching music videos or even sometimes watching porn and saying, oh, I feel more attracted to the male character. So a boy might say, I feel more attracted to the male character. Or a boy would say, I didn't think Britney Spears was that hot, but I thought the boys in her videos were hot. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of things that they start to become aware of sort of the direction that their desire is going in terms of gender. So this idea of when we were talking earlier about this idea of heteronormativity, that the normal way to be is men and women attracted to each other. So these kids would become aware that somehow they weren't fitting that norm. And sometimes that was things other people said to them, and sometimes that was things they were experiencing. And then, I think this exploring that starts to happen, and particularly in the context of our culture where there's just very little representation of same-sex desire, that, you know, how do you find yourself represented in society? You know, what do you do with those feelings when the very dominant message is that that's not normal and that's not okay?
And figuring this out is work that for queer young people is much more on the surface than it is for straight ones, right? Because, like, as a straight person, I was never encouraged to think about how I realized I was attracted to men.
Yes. And that's so important. Yet, if you were asked that question, you could really, you know, you could sit down and think about it and start to think of all the messages that you received, all of the lessons that you were learning since the very beginning that were pushing you in that direction. And again, this idea of a heteronormative culture makes it so that socialization is very invisible, that is just taken for granted. But if we were to really sit down and quantify the number of hetero representations, hetero images that we've consumed over the course of our lives, you know, it's a bigger number than we can conceive compared to if you were trying to quantify how many representations or images or ideas of non-hetero desire. And so, yes, that if you don't fit that norm, it stands out to you and it stands out to others.
So some of these teenagers hadn't yet had like a physical sexual experience that reflected their sexual orientation, which, I mean, first and foremost tells us that there's more to a queer identity than just sex. Did they feel like they had the right to claim those identities before they had lived them in the fullest sense of the word?
Yes, and I really love that about these kids. I think that, and I think that's something that's, you know, really is a marker of a shift, a generational shift. But absolutely, I think that I never had a kid say to me, oh, you know, I think I'm gay, but I haven't had sex with the person yet to say that. Nobody ever said that. You know, people said, oh, I'm gay, I'm bi, I'm pan, I'm, you know, whatever their identity was. And so, and I did have, I'm thinking of one person in particular who identified as a girl and as bisexual, but she had only had sex with a boy. And so she hadn't had sex with a woman, but she knew that her identity was bisexual. She's certain about that. And so absolutely, these kids, they're making decisions about that based on a kind of constellation of ideas and things that are happening to them, not necessarily because they're actually engaging in a particular type of sexual intimacy.
So you did do your research in a place that encouraged young people to be very open about their sexuality. Do you think you would have had different responses if you had been able to go into a public school and take a group of kids into a room who were maybe your subset of young people was farther down the road of understanding themselves than they might have been if they hadn't found a place like Spectrum?
Yeah, I do think that that's true. And I think that there's a couple different things that are important about that. I say in the beginning of the book that the kids who are coming to Spectrum, you had to be quite brave and quite ready to sort of jump into this world to show up at Spectrum. If you were really scared and really not comfortable with the thought of being a queer kid, you couldn't have even stepped foot on the property. You know, it really takes a lot of bravery to show up. And so, you know, I think that obviously shows that those particular kids had a certain sense of themselves already. But then I think that, you know, something that we sort of forget about LGBT and queer people is the idea that, you know, there's this pressure on them to reflect on their sexuality, talk about their sexuality, acknowledge their sexuality, you know, in earlier, sooner, and in a way that straight people just can kind of ignore and not talk about. And so I think that creates this context of having a more informed, educated, comfortable sense of oneself around sexuality, particularly if you're coming together in community like that. And so I think it would have been harder. I think it certainly would be harder. I think it would have been a lot of fun to ask all kinds of high school students, you know, how do you know you're straight? How do you know you're gay? How do you know this? But I do think these young people had a certain awareness.
To the extent that the adults who were running the parent organization resource and using its services tended to be more homonormative LGBT folks, were they completely comfortable with the more queer aspects of the way that the Spectrum kids identified?
That's a good question. So, you know, I have to say that, you know, to be fair, I think the framing of the difference, the sort of queer and homonormative, was maybe skewed on Spectrum's side. So I don't know that the resource would agree with that. Mm-hmm. You know, that it would be interesting to ask them because I really didn't spend time there. This space was really separate. And but I do think that I noticed things that made me feel like the resource sometimes didn't quite get the kids that were there, that perhaps sometimes they didn't really see some of the other ways that they were marginalized by race and class and some of these other things. And again, I don't want to suggest that the resource as an organization was not dealing with its own population of folks who were dealing with poverty and these issues. But sometimes I felt like they kind of, you know, it's kind of the youth, it's like we do in society, you know, this kind of marginalization of the youth in an organization of like, oh, those are the kids, they're going to do that thing, they're downstairs doing, you know, that. Sometimes I felt like that might have been the case.
So lots of us will remember trying on different identities in adolescence, a process that is in no way limited to sexual and gender orientation, and ultimately landing in adulthood at something else, often something a little more moderate. Do you have reason to believe some of these young people who define themselves as queer in the moment and who defined being queer as being outside mainstream LGBT norms might in fact settle into identities that are more mainstream in the future?
Yeah, I think that's certainly, absolutely. I think for some of them will be the case. And I think that's another thing that I really love about places like Spectrum is just that it creates this space to explore and try things on and take things off, and you don't have to be one thing or another. And I think that's such a great thing for us to encourage in our society. But I do think that adulthood, you know, imposes norms on us. And so, you know, for example, when we think about sexual identity or sexual orientation, you know, if we live in a society where the norm is to pair up and marry and be monogamous and have long-term relationships and families, then, you know, it forecloses on the idea that, oh, you might, you know, be moving around in your sexual orientation identity. Because if you find the person, if you find your person and you match up with that person regardless of their gender, then you kind of get, that becomes your sexual identity. And we sort of forget that, oh, well, if that person was there, maybe you would be exploring something else or doing something else. So we see these kind of social institutions impose norms onto us. And I think that's one of the nice and fun things about adolescence is that you get to, that is a moment of exploration, but sometimes we sort of discount that as if that's not real or it's temporary. But in fact, that is, it is part of becoming who you're going to be.
Something that has struck you as problematic is the way that media portrayals of LGBT and queer young people often like lean really heavily on the degree to which they're at risk. Statistics do suggest these teenagers are at greater risk of harassment and of violence and of suicide than their straight peers. But what are we missing when we consider their identities as potentially problematic first and foremost, given those risks?
Yeah, I think it just really sets, it just tells a narrow story and a negative story and overemphasizes risk. And we really tend to overemphasize risk and sexuality with young people no matter what,
right?
Instead of talking about pleasure and opportunity and these things. So, yeah, I think that if you assume that to be LGBT identified is means more risk, if that's the first assumption, I think that's really problematic. And it sets kids up it sets them up for in their own sort of self-construction where they start to think, oh, things are going to be bad for me, you know. And then I think it also, it just sort of, and then it makes invisible all the wonderful celebratory contributions. That, I mean, I think that, I hope that that comes through in the book, is that our culture, we owe, you know, our society at large owes so much to LGBTQ people and the movement and the and pride and all of these things. And so it's, you know, we need to pay attention to the risk and we need to pay attention to kids who are vulnerable, but we could do a much better job of just celebrating young people's vibrant lives and sexualities and genders and their approach to life.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to say, as of 2019, if queer-identified kids face more challenges than homonormative LGBT kids?
I think so. And this is, you know, the data, I think the, as you were talking about some of the statistics, I think risk, even homonormative kids, you know, who are straight looking or straight acting or who have access to resources, we know that they still experience risk. And I think there's continues to be something we really need to continue to have real talk about is the internalized homophobia that all, you know, transphobia and homophobia that all LGBTQ people really are continuing to face in our culture. So I think because we really are not at a place where this is affirmed and accepted and encouraged, you know, I think that still goes on. But I think that it's a mistake to assume that just all LGBTQ kids are the same. And so I like the, you know, I think paying attention to how are, who out of those kids are more vulnerable and why are they more vulnerable and what is that about? You know, is that related to access to resources? Is that related to education? Is that related to religion? You know, the, you know, paying attention to the intersecting identities that make some people more marginalized than others.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. James is on the line in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, very interesting discussion. I wanted to go back to the very beginning when you talked about how you got into the field. In particular, I read somewhere, and unfortunately I can't remember where, that sexuality and how we identify can almost be thought of as sort of like an accent, like a French accent, a Russian accent. The parallels being it's not necessarily genetic, but on the other hand, it's something that we learn early on and it's also something extremely difficult to change. So it has something to do with how the brain works. And, you know, going more into what you're currently looking at, normative versus non-normative, you know, how does that play into, you know, the baser or the more fundamental underlying way a person is? And if that's, you know, I don't know if you understand my question or not, but...
Yeah, I think that's a great, and that is a really interesting analogy, the idea of an accent. I think, you know, another way that I've heard when we're thinking about sexual and gender identity described is sort of like religion. You know, if you ask a devout Catholic, for example, you know, well, were you born Catholic or can you not be Catholic? I mean, this idea, it's almost... it's sort of the wrong question to ask, I think, in a way, is like, how, you know, are you born or genetically gay? Is that, you know, is that how you, or straight? Is that how you came by that? But yes, exactly. I think your idea of the accent, it is something that we're learning that you learn through various processes in your life, starting at a very young age. And I think the most important thing is less, you know, how did you come to have the desire that you have? That's not the question that's important. The question is, can you express that desire in a society in a way that's, you know, are you going to be allowed to do that in a healthy, happy way?
Mary Robertson is my guest. She's assistant professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos, and author of Growing Up Queer, Kids and the Remaking of LGBTQ Identity. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Mary Robertson. She's assistant professor of sociology at California State University, San Marcos, and author of the book Growing Up Queer, Kids and the Remaking of LGBTQ Identity. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. It's fair to say that LGBTQ teens today have a better chance than their counterparts in earlier generations of being accepted by their loved ones for who they are. But obviously, it's not everybody. What did your study subjects tell you about their families that stood out to you?
One of the things that was a really interesting thing to discover with these young people is that most of them had relatively positive experiences disclosing their sexualities to their parents. And they, you know, oftentimes framed it in ways, you know, that they expected it to go poorly and they were afraid of the consequences. They were afraid of being kicked out of their homes. They were afraid of their parents' reactions. But that when their parents found out, and oftentimes it was the case that parents would ask the kids as opposed to the kids, you know, coming to their parents and telling them, when they did have that exchange, they were surprised that it actually went pretty well and their parents had a positive reaction. And like you said, this is not a universal experience by any stretch, but there was a significant number. And so what's interesting to me about that was, it goes back to this idea of vulnerability and risk, is that if we keep telling this story that kids coming out to the parents are going to abandon their gay kids, you know, I think then kids start to adopt that idea and are less likely to talk to their parents and are scared to talk to their parents. Do go well, they think that they're an exception. And that was really striking to me, that the expectation is that coming out should be a horrible experience. And then when it's not, it's like, oh, I'm lucky, or I must be, you know, something's different about me.
Yeah, I think this aspect of your research will stay with me because, I mean, gratitude is always a good thing, you know, the sense that you're lucky. But it's worth noting we never think of straight kids as being lucky that their parents don't kick them out when they start embodying like cisgender norms and acting on heterosexual attractions. Are we a long way away from a society that assumes families can handle raising a queer child?
I don't think so. And I think, you know, if we're going to go back to sort of paying attention to heterosexuality in the context of that conversation, I think that most parents are not really great about talking to their teen about their sexuality.
Of
regardless
any kind, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think about, just to give you an example, something I think about a lot is pregnant teenage girls. So pregnant teenage girls have to do a sort of coming out with their parents where they have to at some point tell them. And that and what that means is that they're telling them, oh, hey, I've had sex. And so I think the same thing, if you're coming out to your parent as a queer identified kid, you're having to have this sex talk with your parents, essentially. And most kids don't do that. And so, you know, you get to kind of avoid that. And definitely if you're a straight kid, one of the privileges of that is that you don't have to have that conversation with your parents, you know, in most cases. And so I think that so it's important to kind of acknowledge that we're actually asking a lot of these kids when we say, oh, you have to come out to your parents. But I do think that I think many more parents are really open to the idea of a queer kid. But what I hope is for it to become non-exceptional, that it's just is. And it's not a big deal that your kid is straight or gay or whatever, or trans, or, you know, that it's just your kid.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go on the phones now to Jessica in Plano. Hi, Jessica.
Thank you for having me. I had a question. I'm super thankful that you said that you hope that it's not exceptional to have a gay kid. That's really cool to hear. But I was curious about your thoughts in regards to the way the LGBTQ community is kind of the resources that are given to these kids, because once they grow up, you know, and they want to be in these relationships with another person or get married, the community that they are a part of doesn't actually support that in a way. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of older LGBTQ community that all they want to do is go out and get drunk and do all of these drugs. And the community itself doesn't support growth in regards to having a, you know, successful long-term relationship. And I was just curious what you kind of thought or saw in these younger kids or thought about that.
Well, Jessica, yeah. Thank you for calling. And I don't know if your experience of the adult LGBT community reflects what Jessica's observations have been, but maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, I think I do appreciate, you know, that's something that young queer kids do talk about is this, you know, sort of, well, let me back up and say that I think your point is really important that in this conversation about sort of homonormativity, I don't want to suggest that monogamous long-term marriage for LGBT is a problem. I think, you know, we need to support that. You know, we need to support all the ways that people want to be in the world. And so I do appreciate that. And I think, yes, I don't want to stereotype older generations of LGBT people as being, you know, in the way you describe, but I definitely think that there is this tension between generations in the LGBT community of sort of, but I think that's really normal. You know, older folks are always sort of critical of younger folks, and younger folks often think that the older folks are, you know, old fashioned and doing it wrong. And there is this interesting tension right now. And I think particularly when you have a community that had to really suffer and had to work so hard and to access these freedoms that now this younger generation of people, in a sense, almost, you know, takes for granted. I think that must be very hard.
I hope that you'll correct me if I am sort of reading this situation wrong. It's my sense, having read this book and sort of being in the world, that this generation of queer young people coming of age now appears to be more comfortable embracing lots of different kinds of fluidity in their lives and identities than previous generations of either straight or gay and lesbian people. And I wonder if you can talk about how that predicts the kind of adult lives that they'll lead.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, it appears on the surface that they're embracing fluidity more. And I think, you know, I think actually probably that, you know, older generations of LGBT community already was embracing fluidity. And now what's happened is that thanks to their activism and their education and their awareness raising, that that's actually now spreading not only through LGBTQ kids, but also among straight kids. And so now, you know, so-called straight kids. So now young people of all ilks are exposed to this idea of fluidity in a way. And so I think the younger generation, period, regardless of their sexual identity or orientation or gender identity or orientation, is less rigid in their sort of need to adopt a fixed identity. So yes, fluidity in gender and sexuality, I think, is becoming more of a norm with young people. And so I can't help but think that that's going to have a profound effect on how those kids develop as adults, how they raise their kids. I really like the idea of, without foreclosing on people's right to have whatever identity they want, I really like the idea of moving away from the idea that one has to have a sexual identity or a gender identity. I think in many ways that's been really restrictive for all of us. So I think there's a profound change. And I think the backlash, backlash against gender ideology is also a sign that something big change has happened, because this pushback is deeply present right now. And I think backlash is always a sign that something has shifted.
If the young people at Spectrum who identified as queer didn't always relate so well to the adults at the resource, are they looking for role models somewhere in the community? Where are they finding them? Do they feel like they need adult role models to figure out this aspect of their lives?
I really love the way you asked that. I think that in the space itself, during the time I was there, and obviously the staff who worked there, that changed across time, but there was one young staff member, so an adult, but a fairly young adult who was running programming, and he was so, the youth loved him so much and looked up to him so much, and that tended to kind of be the norm. Whoever the sort of young adult staff people that were in charge were really, really important to the young people and really became important mentors. And so I think yes, having those role models is important. I think having role models, seeing teachers and pastors and coaches and, you know, all of the adults that come in and out of kids' lives, aunties and uncles and cousins and parents, obviously, you know, having LGBTQ identified people in all of those realms is really important for young kids. But that said, I also think that sometimes they really wanted the adults to get out of the way. And I think that's another thing that we, our culture really, if we want to think about sort of oppression and marginalization and who has rights in our society, we really marginalize minors in the U.S. And I think these kids are amazing and they're doing incredible things. And I'd like to see them have more space to sort of determine their own lives.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Back to the phones now. We'll speak with Linda in Flower Mound. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Thank you for having this conversation. Mine's, I think, more of a comment than a question. You were talking about the way that the youth are portrayed in the media and talking about risk. And then you were also using the word vulnerability. And it occurred to me that risk, I think, sort of implies a choice where not, you know, there are choices that people make as a result of maybe their sexual or gender identity or orientation, but there are also some things that aren't choices. And so when we talk about vulnerability as opposed to risk, it's, you know, what assumptions are we making?
Well, thank you for your call, Linda. Do you want to respond to that, Mary?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that is a lot of the theme running through the book about queerness, that not all LGBTQ kids are vulnerable in the same way. And so, yeah, I think there's the kind of queerer you are, that's the way I frame it in the book, and that queerness coming from all these different sort of identities and social positions, that perhaps the more vulnerable you are. And so I do appreciate that distinction.
I hesitate to ask you to boil years of work in your life down to one thing, but is there a particular takeaway you have for folks who maybe have previously thought of queer and LGBTQ or LGBT as fully interchangeable terms?
Yeah. I think that And I want to emphasize this comes from many decades of many other scholars having this conversation. This is a long debate in the movement. But I do think queer has important meaning and it has important purchase in the larger conversation. And I don't mind that queer has become this kind of catch-all term, but I think as a scholar, as an academic, as somebody who studies sexualities and has a history of understanding queer theory and feminist theory, I think queer is an important distinction as in its meaning of being not normal, and that so much socialization in society is about normalizing people, and normalization is where so much harm sort of happens, but it's also where the boring happens. And so I love that, you know, I do think that queerness is distinct from just LGBT, and I hope that we can sort of keep thinking of queer in that way and keep using queer beyond just sexuality and gender, because I think it can be used to help us understand, again, the way that we're socialized and the normalizing process of socialization.
Mary Robertson is Assistant Professor of Sociology at California State University, San Marcos. Her book is called Growing Up Queer, Kids and the Remaking of LGBTQ Identity. Mary, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.